The Tom Woods Show, episode 2303.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am absolutely delighted to have Gabriel Shipton here with us. His brother, you may have heard of, Julian Assange, has endured rather an extraordinary ordeal, as most of us know, and he is here to talk about a documentary film I just watched last week called Ithaca, and it, of course, talks about the arguments for and against Julian Assange and the truth or otherwise behind them, but it really is a story about the family members, about Julian's father, about his wife, and what it's like enduring this terrible trial of dealing with somebody who's unjustly imprisoned and faces a very, very uncertain future. So, Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
This is such a stunning film, so stunning. And in fact, after I finished watching it, I felt so utterly helpless after watching it that all I could do was I went to my 160,000 followers on Twitter and I just blasted Trump, saying, here is a guy who had the opportunity to just put a stop to this. He could have just put a stop to this, but he let himself be intimidated. And yet for all his bluster about how he's going to drain the swamp, he couldn't do this one act of justice and decency. So to hell with him forever. And I know everybody, you know, has negative things to say about Donald Trump, so it doesn't take a huge amount of courage for me to say it. But it's so frustrating to be in this situation when it could have been reversed. But we'll get to that in a minute. Let's start indeed with just a few points about the case against Julian Assange himself. There are a lot of falsehoods out there. For example, I think the average person just consuming ordinary news media thinks people died because of information that Julian Assange published. Now, what's the truth behind this?
Well, that's a complete fabrication. It was during the Chelsea Manning trial. Even the prosecutors in Julian's case admit that they can't find anyone who came to any harm because of these releases. And it was during Chelsea Manning's hearing, Chelsea Manning being the leaker of the Iraq war files, the Afghanistan war logs, the State Department cable set, and the Guantanamo detainee files. That is the leak that Julian is being prosecuted for publishing. And it includes evidence of war crimes, evidence of torture, and many other instances of corruption all around the world. And it was during Chelsea Manning's hearing that we heard from an ex-general who was hired by the Obama administration to conduct an investigation into this. And the Obama administration actually spent $6 million conducting an investigation into the leaks to try and discover if anybody actually came to harm through these leaks. And they couldn't find anyone. And so during the Chelsea Manning trial, we heard testimony from this ex-general that they could not find anybody who came to harm in relation to these leaks. And in fact, they've really had the opposite effect. You know, it's just been the 20th anniversary of the Iraq war. And arguably, WikiLeaks' most famous release is related to the Iraq war, the collateral murder video, which shows an Apache helicopter gunship gunning down two Reuters photojournalists, and then also shooting up the van that comes to rescue them. Now, in that van, there were two children who also were shot at the time. So it's that video that sort of revealed what was really going on in Iraq to the American people and to people, all the armies, all the nations involved around the world involved in that conflict. It exposed to their populations back home what was actually happening in the war in Iraq. And I think that was really a turning point, which eventually led to the withdrawal of American troops and the beginning of peace in Iraq. And arguably, It saved lives. These releases saved lives. And what really is what we see time and time and again in Julian's persecution is Julian shone a light on these crimes. And the people who he shone a light on have turned it back around and shone it on him to take the tension away from what they've done. And we see that time and time again. And it's a sort of tried and tested technique often used against whistleblowers, but in this case, used against Julian Assange.
I wish I could remember who it was in the film who says something along the lines of, maybe it's Julian himself, talking about the huge protests on the eve of the 2003 war in Iraq. Enormous protests. And yet, despite those enormous protests, the war went on anyway. And that really emphasized the impotence of the people. I mean, we hear all this talk about the glories of democracy, but you have massive, massive protests, and it doesn't do a single thing. There's something extremely discouraging about that, and nothing would make me happier than to see Julian Assange free. But yet it almost seems like no matter how many of us shout at the top of our lungs that we demand this, it just doesn't seem to matter to whoever these people are who rule us.
Well, that was a particular situation, and Iraq and that war sort of fits in this period that led to the development of WikiLeaks. And I think we show that in the film as a sort of inspiration to Julian, you know, why he started WikiLeaks. He saw this problem that even though these huge protests couldn't stop the war, it was brought to an end by courageous people. It was all these courageous protesters, but it was the really courageous people, these courageous whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning, who eventually brought the war to an end. So I think this courage to stand up to these people who govern us, or whether we think something is right or wrong, I think that exists in those protesters, but also exists in these whistleblowers. So I think it's a very human trait, and we shouldn't overlook these large movements, because really it is sort of this group courage that's been displayed en masse. And in Julian's case, we've seen a sort of progression. Really, things started to change November last year when the five prestige newspapers that collaborated with WikiLeaks on the State Department cable set wrote a letter to Merrick Garland calling on the endless prosecutions of Julian Assange to be brought to an end. And so those prestige newspapers are The Guardian, The New York Times, Le Monde in France, El País in Spain, and Der Spiegel in Germany. So publishers around the world can see the threat that this prosecution is to their standing in our societies. And that's why they're writing letters to people like Merrick Garland. Shortly after that, I think it was the next day, we saw the Australian Prime Minister calling on, or making a public statement actually, saying that he'd made representations to the Biden administration to bring this matter to a close, to end Julian's incarceration. And then not long after that, we saw the Press Freedom Coalition, which is made up of ACLU, Human Rights Watch, Committee to Protect Journalists, Amnesty International, all the largest US-based organizations, 24 of them. They wrote another letter to the Garland DOJ calling for it to be dropped. Now, there hasn't been a response from the Garland DOJ, but what we've seen is that these things give cover for it to progress. And so now we're finally seeing some movement inside Congress where Rashida Tlaib is leading a Dear Colleagues letter to the Garland DOJ, and she has four sign-ons already on that letter. And that is really, to me, that is some serious progress in the US. We've been lobbying Congress for years, particularly the Democrat side, because it's a Democrat administration at the moment. And this is the first time we've seen any grouping like that. So to me, we are really seeing some progress here.
Well, thank you. That response gave warm and comfort to my sad heart. I'm actually going to check out that letter. I can think of at least one congressman who definitely needs to be a signatory to that. Also, the key figure in this film really is your father. He has quite an extraordinary temperament, doesn't he? He seems unflappable. He's very soft-spoken. He doesn't lose his temper, but he's firm. If people say something wrong, he's going to correct them. And so we watch him as he goes and he does media interviews. He's flying all over the place to help out Julian. Toward the end, though, he seems overcome by despair. And it's quite jarring because up to this point, he'd seemed quite stoic.
Yeah, so we really try in the film to just express how dire the situation is and the sort of low points that we come across in the campaign and how we keep going or how John keeps going. And I think it's really, when you're fighting in any cause bigger than yourself, it's not going to be a bed of roses. There are going to be low points and there are going to be moments where you feel like you've had a win or a victory. And I think showing that low point and showing that John still gets up the next day and keeps going in the fight to free Julian, to me, it's sort of inspiring that even when you think all is lost, that you can still get up the next day and get out of bed and really just keep putting one foot in front of the other, fighting for the freedom of his son, but also fighting for all our freedom, because Julian has been made an example of, to send a message to all journalists, to all publishers, that if you give this sort of information to the public, this information that exposes our crimes, we're going to come after you. But really, that's what we wanted to show with that, is that even during those low times, we keep going.
I guess in some ways, what defines you is how you respond in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds, particularly when a loved one's well-being is at stake. The other figure who looms very large in this film, other than Julian himself, is of course his wife, who was originally simply part of his legal team, and whose devotion to him is quite striking. And we are given a taste of what family life is like and how she stays in contact with him and talks to him about which bedtime story she's going to read to the children. I don't know what to say about it. It was, for me, quite overwhelming as a parent myself to observe this.
Yeah, well, there's incredibly intimate scenes with Julian and Stella, how they live their family life, that there's two young children who are part of this, and seeing behind the scenes, seeing how Julian is as a father, as a husband, but also as a son, I think really is a perspective that the public has never seen before. And it really humanizes him in a way. You know, Julian suffered this 10 plus years of dehumanization and demonization. Just recently, part of the dehumanization is that he hasn't been able to attend any of his court proceedings since January 2021. He applies to the court to be able to go and attend the court proceeding, but they always refuse and they don't give a reason. But what that means is that one of the little moments that a press photographer can take a photo in the prison van no longer exists. And so we don't, as the public, there is no image of Julian. Julian has been hidden. He is held in incommunicado. He cannot use his voice. And that's been the case for the last 4 years while he's been in that prison. And really showing how he relates to his family, I think, really humanizes him in a way that's never been done before.
Not to mention, we are told, I suppose we could have guessed this, that during lockdown, his life, because in 2019 he winds up in prison, and his life gets even worse because of the lockdown. I assume his communication with other people is extremely limited during that time. Was it something like solitary confinement?
Yeah, I mean, when he first was in the prison, he was being held in solitary confinement in the maximum security prison at Belmarsh. And interestingly, it wasn't his lawyers that got him out of that situation. It wasn't politicians advocating for him to get him out of that solitary confinement. It wasn't the UN, you know, the special rapporteur on torture, Niels Melzer, a UN official, was also writing reports on the way his prison conditions, and nothing was being done. But it was the prisoners who did 3 petitions requesting the governor remove Julian from the solitary confinement situation that he was in, that eventually led to him being put in a different part of the prison. And I think that's a really neat little example of how things change in Julian's case. It doesn't come from the top down. It always comes from the bottom up when it comes to Julian. And during that COVID period, he didn't have any visits, I think, for 8 or 9 months. The only way he could see Stella was through those video calls that you see in the film. He had very little access to his lawyers during that period as well. So that made his defense even more difficult than it was, than it is. You know, this expectation of due process doesn't really exist in Julian's case. He's had very little access to his lawyers. Getting papers in and out of the prison has been immensely challenging. And there's just been these constant hurdles, blockages put up in front of Julian that has not allowed him to have his right to due process.
Well, not to mention, I don't know how I hadn't known about this, but we find out that apparently the CIA had somehow been recording when he was at the Ecuadorian embassy, and they'd been recording all the visits he had had, even from legal counsel.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And there was a report, a Yahoo News article, Zach Dorfman, Mike Isikoff, two Washington, D.C. reporters who did a 6,000-word investigation into this, over a year of investigating these plots that were emanating from within the CIA. And what they uncovered was not only was UC Global the security company that was supposed to be protecting Julian, they were turned against him. And so not only were they recording his meetings with his lawyers, his meetings with his doctors, they put microphones all through the embassy. Even they put microphones in the ladies' bathrooms because they thought that Julian might have meetings in the ladies' bathrooms. And so they put recording devices in there. And through this investigation by these Washington, D.C. journalists, we found out that every 15 days, the CEO of this security company was flying from Spain to the USA with this material and handing it off to the Pompeo CIA. And it doesn't sort of stop there. There were reports in this article that said that there were plans to kidnap Julian from the embassy that went as high as the White House. And these reporters say that Pompeo came up with this plan when he was CIA director, and he took it to the Justice Department. And the Justice Department said, well, if you kidnap him, what do you think you're going to do with him? We don't have any charges here. Before you go ahead, why don't you let us put something together? And that's when we see these sort of unprecedented use of the Espionage Act really come about. And ironically, Mike Pompeo, in his recent book, I don't want to sort of promote his book here, but there is a section on Julian Assange, and he claims credit. He claims credit for successfully lobbying the Ecuadorians to allow the UK police into the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Julian spent 7 years, to grab him and take him to this prison. And he also claims credit for this prosecution. So this is a sort of confirmation that this entire thing is political.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with the law. It's a political persecution that sort of emanated from the Pompeo CIA.
Well, you don't have to worry about inadvertently promoting his book. I can say after 2,300 episodes of this show, there is not a single listener who would be interested in reading the Mike Pompeo book. But all the same, the film is leading up in large part to the hearing about extradition, whether Julian would be sent to the United States. And nobody wants that because there's no way he'll be treated fairly and there's no way he'll be treated humanely. So we have both considerations. And so what we get, I think I'm not really giving anything away in a sense in the film, but we find out that initially, at least, the decision was he would not be extradited, and people are happy about that. But then another figure in the film comes out and says, but wait a minute, everybody, be careful. Understand that the reasoning behind this decision is simply a fear for his well-being, that he might commit suicide or something. They're not denying, in effect, that the United States runs the world and can make crazy demands like this. So we're absolutely not out of the woods. And as it turns out, it was decided that, well, since the United States has given assurances that he will be treated well, then in principle, he can be extradited. So the battle still goes on. It's just exhausting. I don't even think I have a question here.
Yeah, it just goes on and on. I mean, interestingly, those assurances you mentioned, Amnesty International, when they were released, Amnesty International came out and said they're not worth the paper they're printed on. They're not actually assurances at all, because they have the last sentence in it, in the so-called assurances, says that we can change our mind at any time. And the person who actually decides whether they put Julian in these oppressive special administrative measures prison conditions is the director of the CIA. So this is the very agency that plotted to kidnap Julian, plotted to actually murder him as well. So that's the sort of assurances that we can expect if Julian is extradited. And if he is extradited, he will be tried in the Eastern District of Virginia. And now this court, known as the Espionage Act Court, has 100% conviction rate. It has the same sort of conviction rate as what you would expect as a court in Beijing. So that's the sort of justice that Julian can look forward to.
Now, I don't want to attribute to you ideas that might complicate your efforts or put words in your mouth. So I'll just say, just speaking for myself, the way I look at the world and the regimes that run much of the world, I feel like a lot of the people we're talking about are quite sinister. And the way they've dealt with Julian, they've made that amply clear. And yes, they come in different flavors. In the United States, we have the Democrats and the Republicans, but there are sinister Democrats and sinister Republicans. And so I think that one of the betrayals of Julian has come from people on what we might in the United States call the establishment left. They were all for Julian if he was embarrassing George W. Bush. But if he embarrasses Hillary Clinton, well, Hillary Clinton is on our side. I don't understand the planet people live on if they think Hillary Clinton is on their side. I think it's two wings of the same bird of prey. But I think these people who should be standing by his side feel like, well, he exposed the wrong person, so suddenly I don't have any principles anymore. Am I asking too much to have you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the principles that are at stake in this case, I think that's where we always come back to, because the precedent that will be set, or that is being set in the case of Julian Assange, applies to everybody, all publishers, all journalists, anybody who has even touched classified information or classified material. And it's very easy to lose sight of what would this precedent be done in the hands of a Republican administration, potentially led by DeSantis. What could we expect them to do with this sort of precedent? And really, I think that's what Democrats should look at. And revenge, or this malice that surrounded Julian's case, it can be blinding. And it's our job as advocates for Julian to always talk about the principles at stake, the principles of free press. Robert Kennedy Jr., who recently did an interview with my father, said, without the free press, there is no United States. And without a free Julian, there is no free press. And I think that is worth dwelling on and worth thinking about, that without a free press, what sort of country does the United States look like? Does it look more like a China, or does it look more like a Russia than this sort of beacon of freedom that it aspires to be?
I'm sure you've heard that RFK Jr., I guess he's launched an exploratory committee connected to possibly running for president in 2024. And if he were to do that, at the very least, we can say some issues that would otherwise not be mentioned will be mentioned and will get attention. And I hope very much this is one of them. I notice on the website you have a series of screenings coming up around the United States of the film, and that is one way people can watch it. So the website is Ithaca.movie, and that's Ithaca with a K, .movie. I suppose that's where you'd want to send listeners.
Yeah, just jump on the website and you can see where we're screening. John and I, my father and I, are doing Q&A events all around the country. I think we've done probably around 20 events so far, and we have about 30 to go. So we're likely coming to a city near you. The Alamo Drafthouse Cinema is also running the film with theatrical runs in New York City and other locations. And that's all on the Ithaca movie website as well. And I think, yeah, interestingly, you mentioned his exploratory campaign, RFK Jr., because another person who's announced that they're going to run, Marianne Williamson, is also an advocate for Julian's freedom. And so it will be very interesting to see how this issue develops in the campaign for the Democratic nomination.
Well, the more they can criticize Biden from that side of things, probably the better. I mean, why not? Call attention to the issue and see what pressure can be put on him to change his opinions. I mean, what's the harm in giving that a try? What I want to say as we wrap up, I know you're very busy and I'm looking at your schedule. You're like a rock musician. You're in one city one day and another city another day going around screening this film. But I want to urge people, go to that website, check out the film. It's deeply moving. It's extremely well done. It's not exactly the film you think it will be. It's a much more deeply, profoundly personal and moving experience than you expect. And I'm so, so glad that I had the opportunity to watch it. So definitely try to attend one of the screenings. I apologize, I didn't look enough at the website to see, can people also just simply purchase the film for individual viewing?
No, we don't have that available yet, but that is coming. So yeah, stay tuned on the website. You can pop your email in there and we'll send you updates as well with new screenings that are added on or when we have a streaming or a video on demand release. You can also host a screening if you're up for doing that, getting a group of people together and watching it all together. So there's details on the website for that too.
Okay, I'll check that out. Is there like a minimum number of attendees you would want to shoot for a screening?
I would say 10 or 20. You know, people do them in their local libraries or local hall spaces and things like that. And we have a impact producing team that will help you along with that, promoting it and getting the word out about that, because it's a really good way to form community around this film and around the fight to free Julian and a fight for the free press.
Well, once again, the website ithaca.movie, that's Ithaca with a K. Gabriel Shipton, thanks so much for your time and for your tireless efforts. And we are all hoping very much that they pay off abundantly.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you so much.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com. Why the name? Why did you name the documentary this?
It's a poem. It's named after a poem by C.P. Kavafi, a Greek-Egyptian poet. He wrote a poem called Ithaca, based on the Odyssey, and it talks about the journey and not the destination, and sort of fits well for our work that we're doing to advocate for Julian when, you know, we're up against a all-powerful superpower and our goal seems so far away that, you know, at times it's good to refocus and think about the people that we've met on this journey and the places that we've been, the new friends that we've made and the things that we've learnt, and that helps us keep going.
That was very beautifully said. Even though we haven't officially started, I may take that if you don't mind. And at the end of our conversation, I'll tack it on as a little bonus. Okay, you ready?
Yes.
Off we go.